A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
You know that moment when you smell smoke in the stairwell and your brain runs through the checklist? Someone's burning toast, someone's cooking goes sideways, and then you hit the one where it's not dinner. That half second where your stomach drops before you even know why. Daniel's been thinking about that moment and what comes before it. He sent us a prompt this week that starts from something he's noticed living in Jerusalem. Israel gets a lot of forest fires, heat waves, arson spikes, the Carmel going up every few years. But domestic fires, house fires, apartment fires, they don't seem to dominate the news the way you'd expect. He wants to know whether that perception holds up in the data, and more broadly, what actually starts fires indoors, residential, commercial, industrial? What's preventable, and what can you actually do about it at home or in a business? So we pulled the USFA and NFPA data to see if Daniel's intuition holds up, and the answer is more interesting than yes or no.
His intuition is partly right, and the reasons are structural. Israel does have a lower rate of domestic fires per capita than the US. The Carmel fire in 2010 killed 44 people, and that was a watershed. It tightened fire codes significantly. But the bigger factor is construction. Most Israeli residential buildings are concrete and stone. Timber framing, which is basically kindling with a roof, is rare here. You also have a younger housing stock, on average. Less of that outdated wiring that haunts American homes from the 60s and 70s.
So if you're living in a concrete box, you've already got a head start on fire safety, just from the materials.
Concrete doesn't burn. It can spall under extreme heat. The surface pops off in chunks, but it doesn't contribute fuel to a fire the way wood framing does. A fire in a concrete apartment stays in that apartment. A fire in a wood-framed building can travel through the walls and attic into adjacent units without ever being visible from the outside. That's why American firefighters talk about pulling ceiling. They have to physically open up the void spaces to see if the fire is already in the structure.
So Daniel's observation holds up. But it's not because Israelis are more careful in the kitchen.
They're not. And here's where the data gets interesting. The cause breakdowns, what actually starts fires, those are remarkably consistent across countries. Human beings are human beings. We leave pans on the stove, we plug too many things into one outlet, we fall asleep with a cigarette. The Israel comparison is a useful lens, but the real story is universal.
So let's start with the residential data, because that's where the numbers are most surprising.
The USFA tracks this in granular detail. In 2022, there were roughly 350,000 residential building fires in the United States, 2,600 civilian deaths, $7.5 billion in property damage, and the number one cause, by an enormous margin, is cooking.
How enormous?
49%. Half of all residential fires start in the kitchen.
Half.
And here's the thing, cooking fires only account for 21% of civilian deaths. The lethality per fire is relatively low, but they account for 44% of injuries. That gap tells you something about the mechanism.
People trying to put it out themselves.
Exactly that. The classic scenario is a grease fire. Cooking oil hits its autoignition temperature, around 600 degrees Fahrenheit for most oils, and it just lights. No spark needed. Someone's standing there, pans on the burner, oil's heating up, they turn away for 30 seconds, and then there's a column of flame. And the natural instinct is to grab the pan and move it or throw water on it.
Which is the worst possible thing?
Water hits burning grease, flash boils instantly, and throws burning oil across the entire kitchen. The injury numbers are driven by burns to hands, arms, face, people who tried to carry a burning pan to the sink or out the back door. The correct response is to slide a lid over it and turn off the burner, smother it. But that's not instinctive.
I've actually seen this happen. A friend in college, his roommate decided to deep-fry something in a saucepan. No thermometer, just oil and high heat. The oil hit ignition, and this kid's first move was to grab the pan and start walking toward the back door. He made it about 4 steps before the oil sloshed onto his arm. Second-degree burns, kitchen cabinets charred, the whole thing. And he was a smart guy, engineering major. Just had 0 training for that moment.
That's the thing, intelligence has nothing to do with it. Your brain in a panic reaches for the most familiar action pattern. You've carried pans to the sink thousands of times. You've never smothered a grease fire, so the familiar pattern wins. That's why fire safety training emphasizes rehearsing the response. You need to build the neural pathway before the adrenaline hits, because after, it's too late.
And the death numbers, 21%. Those are the fires that get past the kitchen. The ones where someone wasn't home, or was asleep, and the fire spread into the rest of the house before anyone noticed.
Right. The 2017 Bronx apartment fire is the textbook case. 13 people dead. It started with a 3-year-old playing with a stove burner. The fire got into the walls. Void spaces in multi-unit buildings act like chimneys, and it spread faster than anyone could react. A cooking fire, the most common and supposedly least lethal type, became a mass casualty event because of the building conditions.
So cooking is frequent but survivable, until the building makes it unsurvivable.
That's the first big insight. The second is the lethality inversion with heating equipment.
Space heaters.
Heating equipment is 13% of residential fires, but 19% of deaths. Disproportionately deadly. And the reason is timing. Cooking fires happen when people are awake and in the kitchen. They're noticed quickly. Heating fires tend to happen at night. Someone puts a space heater too close to the curtains, or a blanket falls on it, or it's an old radiator with dust buildup that ignites. The fire starts at 2 or 3 in the morning, everyone's asleep, and by the time the smoke alarm goes off, if there's one, the room is already involved.
The Philadelphia Row House Fire.
2022. 12 dead, 8 of them children. A space heater in a second floor bedroom too close to combustibles. No working smoke alarms in the building. That's the lethal combination, an ignition source that operates while people sleep, and no detection. The NFPA has this rule about a 3-foot clearance around space heaters. It's simple, it's effective, and it's routinely ignored because people underestimate how much heat radiates from those things over time.
3 feet feels like a lot in a small bedroom.
It does, and that's part of the problem. People look at a 3-foot radius and think, that's half my floor space, so they fudge it. 18 inches, a foot, whatever fits. But radiant heat doesn't fudge. A space heater running for hours can ignite combustible materials from a surprising distance, especially if the material is something like a curtain that's moving slightly in a draft, getting closer and farther, until one pass is close enough.
What about electrical?
Electrical distribution and lighting is 6% of residential fires, but 11% of deaths. Same pattern, rarer than cooking, more lethal per fire. The mechanisms are aging wiring, aluminum wiring from the 60s and 70s that corrodes at connections, and arc faults. An arc fault is when electricity jumps through a gap in damaged insulation. It creates intense localized heat, thousands of degrees, enough to ignite wood framing inside a wall, and it can smolder for hours before flames break out.
This is what AFCI breakers are for.
Arc fault circuit interrupters. They detect the specific electrical signature of an arc fault and trip before it can start a fire. The NEC started requiring them in bedrooms in 1999, and the requirement has expanded since then. But millions of homes still don't have them. If your breaker panel was installed before the early 2000s, you probably don't have AFCI protection.
And swapping a breaker isn't something most homeowners think about unless something's already gone wrong.
Right, because the old breaker still works in the sense that it trips on overload. It just won't catch an arc fault. The failure mode is invisible until it isn't. You can live in a house for 20 years with a wiring fault smoldering inside a wall and never know until the night it transitions to open flame.
So we've got cooking at the top by volume, heating as the nighttime killer, electrical as the hidden smolderer. What else is in the breakdown?
Intentional fires, arson, are 7% of residential fires but 15% of deaths. Higher lethality because they're often set with accelerants or in hallways and stairwells that block egress. And smoking materials, 4% of fires, 8% of deaths. The dropped cigarette on upholstery scenario.
That one's declined, hasn't it?
Dramatically. Fire-safe cigarette standards were phased in starting in the early 2000s. They require cigarettes to self-extinguish if not actively puffed. The number of smoking material fire deaths dropped from around 1,000 per year in 1980 to about 500 by 2020. That's a policy success story that doesn't get enough attention. A simple manufacturing standard cut deaths in half.
And the mechanism, they're smoldering.
Yeah. A cigarette falls between couch cushions, smolders for 20 or 30 minutes, then transitions to flaming combustion. The person who dropped it might be in another room or asleep, and by the time there's visible flame, the room is full of smoke. The fire-safe standard works because it interrupts that smoldering phase. The cigarette goes out before it can transition.
You keep coming back to smoldering. The gap between ignition and detection.
Because that's where the deaths happen. A fire that starts while you're standing, there's a fire you can respond to. A fire that starts invisibly, inside a wall or between couch cushions, is the one that kills you. That's why smoke alarms matter so much. They collapse that gap. The NFPA says working smoke alarms on every level of the home reduce the risk of dying in a fire by 55%. Not a small number.
And that's detection, not prevention.
Smoke alarms don't stop fires. They tell you one is happening. Prevention is a different layer. AFCI breakers, not leaving cooking unattended, keeping space heaters clear, not smoking in bed. The full stack is prevention, detection, suppression. Most homes have detection and nothing else.
So that's the residential picture. Cooking dominates, but the killers are heating and electrical. Now let's look at what changes when you walk into a factory or a commercial kitchen.
The numbers shift immediately. The USFA tracks over 100,000 non-residential fires annually in the U.S. Industrial, commercial, storage properties. Cooking drops to 22%. Still number one in restaurants and commercial kitchens, but irrelevant in warehouses or factories. In industrial settings, the top cause is electrical malfunction at 18%, then intentional at 14%, then mechanical failure and equipment at 12%, then heating at 10%.
Mechanical failure. What does that actually mean?
Friction. Overheating bearings. Conveyor belts that seize up and generate enough heat to ignite dust or nearby materials. It's a completely different risk profile from residential. At home, you're worried about the stove and the space heater. In a factory, you're worried about a motor that's been running for 18 hours straight and a bearing that's about to fail.
And the human factor doesn't go away.
Not at all. NFPA data shows about 25% of non-residential fires involve some form of human error. Not arson, but improper storage. The classic example is oily rags. You've got maintenance workers wiping down equipment with solvent-soaked rags. They toss them in a pile in the corner, and the rags self-heat through oxidation. The heat builds up, the pile reaches auto-ignition temperature, and you've got a fire in a storage closet that nobody's checked in 6 hours.
Spontaneous combustion from rags. That's a real thing.
It's a real thing, and it happens regularly. The fix is trivial. Oily rags go in a sealed metal container, not a pile. But it requires training and enforcement. And that's where the gap between code and reality opens up.
I want to pause on this, because spontaneous combustion sounds like something from a Victorian novel. How does a rag just catch fire?
It's chemistry. Certain oils, linseed oil is the classic one, but also many wood finishing oils and some solvents, undergo an exothermic reaction with oxygen. They oxidize, and that reaction produces heat. If the rags are in a pile, the heat can't dissipate. The temperature rises, which accelerates the oxidation rate, which produces more heat, and you get a thermal runaway loop. Eventually, the pile reaches the auto-ignition temperature of the rags themselves, around 400 degrees Fahrenheit for cotton, and they ignite. No spark, no flame, no external heat source. Just chemistry and poor housekeeping.
So it's basically a compost pile, but faster and more dangerous.
That's actually a perfect analogy. A compost pile self-heats through biological activity. An oily rag pile self-heats through chemical oxidation. Same principle. Internal heat generation in an insulated mass, different mechanism. And just like a compost pile can theoretically catch fire if it gets hot enough and dry enough, an oily rag pile will catch fire if you give it time and confinement.
The Worcester Warehouse Fire.
1999. Worcester, Massachusetts. An abandoned cold storage warehouse, 6 firefighters killed. The fire started with 2 homeless people using a candle for light. But the building had no sprinklers, a maze-like layout, and zero compartmentation. The fire spread through open spaces and void areas without resistance. The ignition source was almost incidental. What killed those firefighters was the building.
Prevention isn't just about what starts the fire.
It's about what happens after. Compartmentation. Fire doors, fire walls, rated assemblies that keep a fire in one room for an hour or two, suppression, sprinklers that activate when the temperature hits a threshold, and maintenance of those systems. NFPA 25 governs inspection, testing, and maintenance of water-based fire protection systems. It's the most commonly violated fire code in commercial real estate.
Because it's boring and nothing happens.
Sprinkler systems sit there for years without activating. Valves get corroded, pipes get clogged, pumps fail. Nobody notices because there's no fire. Then a fire happens, the sprinklers don't work, and the building burns down. The difference between a fire that stays contained in a single room and one that destroys an entire building often comes down to whether someone tested the sprinkler system last quarter.
And the lithium-ion battery thing is new.
Relatively new and growing fast. In 2021, a lithium-ion battery storage facility in Arizona had a thermal runaway event. One battery cell fails. The heat causes adjacent cells to fail, and you get a cascading, self-sustaining fire that's extremely difficult to extinguish. Battery fires burn hot. They produce their own oxygen and some chemistries, and they can reignite hours after they appear to be out. As we put more batteries in homes, e-bikes, power walls, electric vehicles charging in garages, the fire service is having to adapt to a completely new risk.
And that's not in the traditional cause breakdown yet. It'd fall under, what, electrical?
Probably, but it doesn't fit neatly. Thermal runaway is a chemical reaction as much as an electrical one. The NFPA is tracking it under emerging technology fires now. E-bike batteries are a particular concern because people charge them in hallways and entryways. If the battery goes into thermal runaway, it blocks the exit.
I've seen videos of these battery failures. It's not a fire that builds gradually. It's like a flamethrower that appears instantly.
That's the thermal runaway cascade. A lithium-ion cell fails at around 150 to 200 degrees Celsius internally. When it fails, it vents hot gases and electrolyte, which are flammable. Those gases ignite, the flame impinges on adjacent cells, they heat up and fail, and the whole thing propagates in seconds. You go from a hissing sound to a jet of flame in less time than it takes to cross a room. And because some battery chemistries generate oxygen during decomposition, you can't smother it. It brings its own oxidizer to the party.
So what actually works? If someone's listening and thinking about their home or their business, what's the highest return intervention?
For residential, three things. One, working smoke alarms on every level tested monthly. That's the 55% death reduction. Two, AFCI breakers in bedrooms and living areas. They catch arc faults before ignition, and they're not expensive compared to rebuilding a house. Three, the cooking vigilance rule. Never leave the kitchen with a hot pan. Keep a lid nearby to smother grease fires. Those three things cover the vast majority of preventable residential fire deaths.
And for a business?
Hot work permits are number one. Welding, cutting, grinding. Any operation that produces sparks or open flame needs a formal permit system and a fire watch. Someone whose literal job is to stand there with an extinguisher for 30 minutes after the work stops. Number two, proper storage of flammable liquids in approved cabinets, not under the workbench, not next to the water heater. Three, regular cleaning of exhaust ducts in commercial kitchens. Grease buildup in hoods and ducts is a massive fire load that most restaurant owners don't think about until it's too late.
And sprinkler maintenance.
Sprinkler maintenance. Test the system. It's not glamorous, it costs money, and 99.9% of the time nothing happens. The 0.1% is why you do it.
All of this data is abstract until you've actually watched a fire start. Hilbert, you've done that, haven't you?
I spent two summers as a fire watch. 1994 and 95. Construction crew building a shopping mall in Paramus, New Jersey. My job was to stand there with a fire extinguisher while guys welded and torched. 400 hours a summer. Nothing ever happened. I was 19. I thought the whole thing was a racket. Insurance companies making us stand around. I'd lean against a column and count ceiling tiles. Then one afternoon, a grinder spark landed in a pile of insulation backing. The stuff had been sitting in a corner for weeks. Nobody moved it. Spark landed, and nothing happened. No flame, no smoke. We went back to work. About an hour later, I smelled something. Took me another 10 minutes to find it. The insulation was smoldering from the inside. A little orange glow, no flame yet, just smoke seeping out of the edges. If I hadn't been there, that pile would have transitioned to open flame sometime after we all went home. The mall was wood-framed at that stage. It'd have gone up. I put it out with the extinguisher I'd been leaning on for 2 summers. The foreman bought me a soda. The mall opened on schedule. The point is, fire prevention is boring until it isn't. Your data says cooking is number one, and that's true, but the fires that kill people are the ones nobody saw coming. The smolder. The space heater at 3 in the morning. The electrical fault inside a wall. Prevention is about the boring stuff. The extinguisher you never use. The breaker that never trips. The sprinkler test that always passes. You do it anyway.
The smoldering insulation. That's exactly the gap between ignition and detection you were talking about.
An hour. A full hour between the spark landing and anyone noticing. That's an eternity in fire terms. And that's with someone standing right there whose literal job was to watch for it. Imagine that same scenario in a house at 2 in the morning. No fire watch, no smoke alarm, or a smoke alarm with dead batteries. That smolder transitions to flame, the room hits flashover in 3 or 4 minutes, and everyone upstairs is breathing smoke before they know anything's wrong.
And Hilbert's story also illustrates something about how we think about risk. He spent 400 hours, that's 10 full work weeks, standing around doing nothing, and the entire value of that time was compressed into about 30 seconds of actually using the extinguisher. The other 399 hours and 59 minutes felt like a waste.
That ratio is exactly why people skip maintenance. The human brain is terrible at valuing interventions where the payoff is invisible and probabilistic. You test a sprinkler valve for the 300th time and it works fine, and your brain says, this is pointless. But the one time it doesn't work, that's when the building burns down. The problem is, you don't know which test will be the one that finds the clogged pipe or the seized valve. It could be next quarter, it could be 10 years from now. The only way to catch is to test every time.
The nothing ever happens. Feeling is the enemy of prevention.
It's the hardest thing to fight. You test your smoke alarms every month for 5 years and nothing happens. You maintain your sprinkler system for a decade and it never activates. The human brain is wired to discount risks that don't materialize. We're terrible at maintaining vigilance against low probability, high consequence events. And fire is exactly that.
So where does this leave us? Daniel's intuition about Israel having fewer domestic fires is partially right. Construction matters. Code enforcement matters. But the causes are the same everywhere, because human behavior is the same everywhere. The lesson isn't move to a concrete building.
The lesson is that fire prevention is a system. Building codes, maintenance culture, human behavior, and technology all have to work together. If any one layer fails, the others have to catch it. The smoke alarm catches what the AFCI breaker didn't prevent. The sprinkler catches what the fire watch missed. The fire door contains what the sprinkler couldn't suppress.
The open question, the thing I keep thinking about, is whether the cause profile is about to shift. More engineered wood in construction. More lithium-ion batteries in homes, e-bikes, power tools, battery backups, electric vehicle charging in garages. The NFPA is already tracking a rise in what they call emerging technology fires. In 10 years, the pie chart might look different.
It almost certainly will. Battery fires are a fundamentally different beast. They don't need oxygen, they're hard to extinguish, and they can start hours after the battery was last used or charged. The traditional prevention playbook doesn't fully apply. We're going to need new standards for battery storage and charging, and probably new suppression technologies.
It also changes the detection layer. If a battery fire can go from zero to inferno in seconds, a smoke alarm doesn't give you the same margin. It does for a smoldering couch cushion.
Right. The whole model of detect early, evacuate, let the fire department handle it, assumes a fire growth curve that gives you minutes. Battery fires compress that timeline dramatically. There's work being done on off-gas detection. Lithium-ion batteries emit specific gases before they go into thermal runaway, so you can potentially detect the failure before the fire starts. But that technology isn't in homes yet. It's mostly in grid-scale storage facilities.
The boring stuff saves lives. The extinguisher you never use. The breaker that never trips. The sprinkler test that always passes. Hilbert's mall never burned down, and nobody who shopped there ever knew how close it came.
If you take one thing from this, it's that the gap between a near miss and a tragedy is maintenance, not heroism, not luck, whether someone checked the batteries, cleared the space around the heater, tested the sprinkler valve. The most effective fire prevention is the stuff nobody sees and nobody thanks you for.
This has been My Weird Proms. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping us on schedule and for 400 hours of leaning on an extinguisher in a New Jersey mall.
If you want to hear us talk about something weird, go to myweirdprompts.com and hit that prompt button. We read everyone. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.